Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Tulips in Tuscany podcast. We're your hosts, Steffi,
Paige,
and Sarah.
And we're on a mission to share your stories and provide some awesome resources for families touring Holland.
We are three moms to some pretty incredible kiddos, and we're excited that you're here to navigate this unexpected journey with us through beautiful Holland.
Hey, guys, today we're going to discuss what comes next after a diagnosis. Whether you've been in our shoes before, having received your child's diagnosis, or perhaps you're still in the process of doing research, calling doctors, or going through the grieving process, we feel like this will be an episode that can offer comfort and maybe even answer some of your scarier questions that you might have. Before we dive in, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
I know I myself can still remember exactly what diagnosis day was like and leaving that doctor's room not knowing what to do or who to turn to. It can be really overwhelming and leave you with a thousand questions, and it left me wondering, to Google or not to Google? Steffi, why don't you share what diagnosis day was like for you and share some of the thoughts that you had in those first few moments?
I'll try to share this without getting emotional. I kind of had two different diagnosis stories, I guess, because we received our NIPT results at 14 weeks. And I remember sitting in our OBGYN's office. My husband was sitting right next to me, and he told us that the test results came back 90% positive that Joshua would have Down syndrome. And I just remember, like, my whole body just went totally, like, numb and black, like everything around me just went black. And I was like, what did you say? And he repeated it, and then he kind of said, you know, don't stress about it yet. We're going to refer you to a geneticist, and kind of started rattling all this stuff. And I honestly barely remember what he said at that point. I was just like in a total fog. Then he walked over. He was like, okay, now I'm going to show you pictures of your baby. And I was just like, I couldn't even look. But he would hand me the ultrasound picture, and I couldn't even look at it. I just like was shaking and passed it to my husband. And finally, what felt like a century later, he walked out of the room, and I just immediately started sobbing. And my husband held me, and we cried. And then immediately after, I got in the car. My husband and I had taken separate cars. So I was just sitting in the car alone after crying, and I called my dad. He was the first person I called. He's always been such a big support in my life. And he's just always been one of those people that knows exactly what to say to make me feel better in that moment. So I called my dad, and I just told him what had happened, and he just listened and let me cry and gave me reassurance, and finally took a deep breath and then drove home. And then Jordan and I went to a genetics counselor that next day. They couldn't get us in for about 24 hours. So that 24 hours was kind of brutal. We really didn't know a ton about Down syndrome. Spent all this time Googling, which was just, gosh, you guys, don't Google. We spent all this time Googling.
Yes.
Yeah, not a great idea. So then, of course, we're like struck with all this fear during this 24 hours. I don't think we slept at all that night. And we went into the geneticist the next day. And she ran through all our family history and all these, she answered all our questions and just gave us a ton more info about the NIPT test, and basically came back and said, so with your age, this test was designed for women over the age of 35, and that's where the 90% comes from. So she said, you are actually around 51%. So we had a 49% chance that he wouldn't have Down syndrome and a 51% chance that he would have Down syndrome. And so we kind of went the rest of our pregnancy not knowing for sure, kind of just a 50-50 toss-up of will he have Down syndrome? We don't know. So that's kind of where the second official diagnosis comes into play, was at birth. We could tell that he had Down syndrome when he was born, but they still took all his blood and did a karyotype and all that. And then the blood work came back about a week and a half later after we had him. And I still remember, I don't know why, I cried again a second time when they gave me the official news. Looked at my husband, I was like, I don't know why I'm crying. I knew he had Down syndrome the second I saw him. But I guess it was just that like official call of them telling me like, yes, he does have full trisomy 21. And then that's kind of when we dove into the world of Down syndrome.
I think it's the finality of that is what makes it so emotional when you get something that's pen and paper or printed ink on paper and you get to see mm-hmm. it and hold it in your hand, even though you've just held your baby, the finality of being able to say, this is for sure what it is. That always hits right. so hard.
Yeah.
And I think with Down syndrome, because there's three different types of Down syndrome, whenever our pediatrician came in, she kind of was like, I just don't know where they're getting it that he has Down syndrome. And I don't know if she was trying to make us feel better in the moment, because she was like, his muscle tone is so good. Like, yes, he kind of has some almond eyes and I can see the button nose, but he doesn't feel like floppy. I put that in quotations because a lot of times babies with Down syndrome have lower muscle tone and they kind of have this like floppy demeanor to them. She even brought up, she was like, there's a type of Down syndrome called mosaic Down syndrome where the extra copy of the chromosome only attaches to certain genes, not all of them. And so they may have some features, they may have some features that are the same as, you know, a typical peer. So then in our mind, we were kind of thinking like, oh, maybe he doesn't have like a full, maybe he doesn't have full trisomy 21. Maybe he has mosaic Down syndrome. When that came back as, yes, he has full trisomy 21, we were kind of felt a little bit let down, I guess, but wouldn't change a single chromosome now. So Paige, you also have a Down syndrome diagnosis as well as autism for Tristan. What was diagnosis day for you like for both diagnoses?
Well, for the first one, we had a little bit of a similar story to you and Joshy because I had a really rocky pregnancy, but I was otherwise healthy. So that was a little bit crazy. And then towards the end, when we were in the maternal fetal medicine specialist's office, that diagnosis day, I will always remember December 19th. It is one of those, I think they call it a flashbulb moment where it just burns into your brain. Like I always remember that day. And I remember sitting in the office and I remember the feel of the pants I was wearing, how it was a little crinkly. I remember being cold. I remember the tint of the light in the room and it just is burned into my head. And when she said you have a 50%, his type of Down syndrome is a little bit different. So it skewed the results of the test that we did. He has a translocation Down syndrome and it's only about 4-6% of all people with Down syndrome. So tests aren't designed for that 4-6%. It's designed for complete trisomy 21, which is the three separate chromosomes. Not to get into the genetics, but the test wasn't designed for Tristan's kind of Down syndrome because his chromosomes are stuck together and it looks like he has regular chromosomes until you do an in-depth karyotype analysis. And so she said it was 52%, but in her expert opinion, she thought it was a lot higher than that because of all the comorbidities, which I hate that word so much, but because of all the other issues that he had, she thought it was higher. And then a chance of skeletal dysplasia and a chance of something she couldn't diagnose. So when she gave us that news, she, I think, could completely see my demeanor change and my husband's demeanor change. And she said, I'm going to give you guys a few minutes. I know I just threw a lot at you. And then she quickly exited so nicely. And I just crumbled. I could not catch my breath. I felt like I was drowning. My husband, you know, we both had tears in our eyes. And it was so incredibly hard to just keep breathing in that moment. And I know that, you know, we had each other in that moment and I'm so grateful we did. I know things have been so different for parents experiencing this right now with the pandemic and everything, but that was something I was really grateful that we had and we were able to move forward from that moment fairly quickly. And I got back in our cars and I obviously did not go back to work that day. I was too devastated and I called out of work for the rest of the day.
I did the exact same thing. I was supposed to go back to work that day and I'll call and I was like, yeah, I can't come in.
Yeah. I mean, I just didn't, I mean, leading up to that point of the pregnancy, it had already been a really scary couple of weeks. And that was just the icing on the cake, so to speak. And I just had been putting up a brave face for so long. I had just not been able to do it that moment. And my boss was just very understanding for me. She said, "Paige, I get it. You're going through some hard stuff. We expect this to happen. And I'm here for you when you need to talk." For our second diagnosis, it was just a phone call. We did the evaluation and we had a meeting set up probably like a month out. And I got a phone call from the physician, the doctor, and she was the sweetest woman I have ever talked to because she was so kind. She said, "I know it's like ripping off a Band-Aid. You were waiting for this phone call. You want to know, does your child have a new diagnosis or not? I'm going to tell you, yes, he does. He has autism. Don't put him in a box." And she proceeded to tell me all these wonderful things that just reminded me about the heart of all the advocacy that we do, about changing stereotypes and opening up your mind to new possibilities and loving your child where they are. And it was hands down the best experience. I mean, I bursted into tears right after she said he has that diagnosis, aww, but I listened to everything she said after. Sarah, with Fragile X diagnosis and it being so incredibly rare, who did you go to in terms of finding out where to go next and what to do next and what therapies Lane would need?
As far as who we went to next, we went to our neurologist to get the Fragile X diagnosis. He had told us that there was a Fragile X clinic, which I never knew about. And we actually got so lucky because it's located in Chicago. And when he was like, "Oh, you know, there's a clinic, a Fragile X clinic through Rush downtown," we're like 45 minutes outside the city. And I was like, "Oh, that's kind of a hike." But he explained that we were so lucky because people from Minnesota, Michigan, all over the world come to this Fragile X clinic in Chicago. So he was like, 45 minutes is nothing. Cool. Like, you're so lucky you have this here. So I was like, okay, 45 minutes, I can do it. He gave us the number for a genetic specialist. And it's actually this like world-renowned doctor, Dr. Barry Kravis. And she does all these research studies and all, she just knows everything about Fragile X. And she's just like the best of the best. So I felt so comfortable. I had read a lot about her and I knew we would be in good hands. We made that appointment. And from there, she just said, "We'll revisit annually." And that was kind of it. We went to her and then she had told us that we would be doing ABA therapy. So I just started researching ABA therapy in the area. And that was kind of it. It was kind of simple for us. It was just like the genetic counselor was going to come next. And we covered our bases with that and then started the ABA therapy.
Can one of you explain what ABA even is?
Sure. So ABA, we've been in it for 2 years now. So it stands for Applied Behavior Analysis, very intensive therapy. And they use positive reinforcement to just improve communication, social skills, reading, academics, you name it. He gets about 25 hours a week. We love it. It's been a saving grace for us. It's been a huge game changer. I can't even remember what life was like before we started ABA. I can't wait for you to start, Paige. Steffi and Paige, I know your kiddos share the same diagnosis, and I'm so curious, do you both have similar therapies, or can you guys tell me about what your kiddos' therapies look like?
All right, I'll go first. I'm going to try to make this as short-winded as possible because I went into overdrive. Tristan was in the beginning of this, we were talking about how they have low muscle tone and Joshie didn't have low muscle tone. Well, Tristan failed his APGAR assessments, all of them, and was in the NICU, and he was like a floppy bunny, and that was our nickname for him, our little floppy bunny, because he was so cute, and so he just would curl up right into you, and he would just melt into you, so he was our floppy little bunny, and that was great because it was cute, but then after a week or so, we realized how that was just debilitating his development. He couldn't hold his head. He couldn't even turn his head to look at you. And that was a really emotional time for me because I had a lot of friends that had babies as well, and their children could at least turn their heads to look at you. And it was just him tracking with his eyes for so long. Sorry, I'm getting really emotional about this one. It was really hard for us to see that. And then I just thought, there has to be something I can do to help him. There has to. What can I do? There is nothing I would not do to help this child. So I went into overdrive, and we do nutritional therapy for him, targeted nutritional therapy, targeting mitigating some of the adverse effects for some of the genes and proteins and repairing mitochondrial function. We do traditional therapy as well, speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and we do neurodevelopmental therapies, and I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting something else. We've pretty much tried everything. So, and some of it I would recommend and some of it I wouldn't, but I always tell everybody, I feel like there isn't one easy button with therapy. There's not one therapy that you can do that you're like, oh, this is it. Mm-hmm. My kid is just crushing it, because everyone is so different and so dynamic. I feel as though all the therapies that we've tried, I've been able to stack his progress little by little with each therapy. They've all helped, and I've seen more gains for him with certain kinds of therapies, but I feel like we've always been able to stack a little bit of progress upon a little bit of progress, although some of it has cost us greatly.
I want to throw in there too that as Paige and I are sharing, and Sarah, about what kind of therapies that we've chosen to do for our kiddos and even ones that we've tried, don't necessarily mean that that's going to be the therapies that works for your loved ones. So it's important to always do your own research and do that for your child, because that may look different. I think it just really depends on your kiddo and what you feel you have time for, what you feel your kiddo can handle, and what you feel like your child needs to help them be the best version of themselves.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important point, because I don't ever want to make parents feel guilty for doing something or not doing it. When I say that it cost us greatly, I mean my time. I spent a lot of time, and also financially, and that's not something that I ever want to brag about, that we were able to do it, because we are in debt. Our medical community, our special needs medical community, I know can be so inundated with medical bills and debt, and that's totally not something I ever want families to feel like they have to go further into debt and do therapies.
So for us, it was very similar. Actually, in the hospital, we gave birth in Orange County, California, and the nurses and doctors there were phenomenal. I will say they threw a ton of info at us, but I guess I would rather have an abundance of information than have been left in the dust. But they had packets, and they had stuff about regional center and who to contact next, and all this stuff about therapies. I mean, it was just a ton of info. And I was like totally feeling overwhelmed at the time. And I didn't even pick up the packet that they gave me for like a month, because I had it in my mind. I was like, you know what? He's my baby. He's going to be my baby first. I just want to enjoy this first month without any stress. Luckily, he didn't have any major medical needs that needed immediate attention right then. So I could just take that time. I could just take that month and just treat him like a baby. So I did. And whenever I finally was ready and I felt like I had kind of coped with the diagnosis, I picked up the packet and I looked at what my steps were. And for me, it was calling regional center in my area. We were living in San Diego at the time. So I called San Diego Regional Center and they scheduled an evaluation for him, which they really didn't, I don't think they came out until he was about 3 months. And I kind of just talked to them about the services, what they could provide, what all that looked like. So they offered early intervention program in our community. Basically, it was like parent consult where they would train the parents how to work with the kids in the areas that they needed, such as OT, PT. Speech wouldn't come till later, but OT and PT were big ones. They kind of helped with some feeding tips and things like that because we had some struggles with bottle feeding. And then I, being an ABA therapist myself, prior to having Joshua, kind of knew the ins and outs of what insurance could do. And so I was glad that I kind of had that background. I was like, okay, I know I can contact a clinic and I could set up OT, PT, whatever I felt like he needed through my insurance and see what they cover. So my next step was calling his insurance and kind of figuring out if I could take him to a clinic somewhere and what was covered and what it, you know, it was going to cost us financially and all that kind of stuff. And so I actually got him in at an occupational therapist and a physical therapist at 4 months for him, which helped. They just worked on little things like trying to teach him to roll and kind of page what you said, even just turning his head and some of that ab core strength. And they would give me workouts to do at home with him. And so we targeted all that stuff at home. And I have the cutest little videos of him at like 4 months old where they're practicing rolling with him at the clinic. And so we ended up doing that all the way through. Well, he's still doing it. It's been totally different since we moved to Arizona and COVID and all that, but he was doing it very consistently. And then at 18 months, he started speech therapy, which they don't usually start speech therapy until they hit 18 months, just because I think that's when some of that receptive language skills start to emerge. So we got him in right at 18 months at a speech clinic. And then he also had someone from early intervention coming to the house. Busy schedule for our little guy.
Can I ask you, so are any of the therapies that they'll grow out of? Like, are they growing out of some, or are these pretty much therapies that they're going to continue to have?
Well, I can speak for Joshua. He started walking right after he turned 2. And the clinic that he was going to for PT was through Rady's Children in San Diego. And they basically said that once he started walking, that they would release him. So he would be done, but then they could schedule, you know, 6 months out to have him come back in for an evaluation to see where he was at and if he needed to be readmitted. So they do release them once they meet certain goals. And it's almost like if they catch up to a point of, you know, where some of their typical peers are, then they may release them if they don't feel like they need it. Like if it's not a medical necessity for them, or even okay. If a pediatrician doesn't feel like it's a medical necessity for them anymore, then they'll say they really don't need this therapy. And you could, you know, release them from that therapy. I do think a lot of kids will grow out of a lot of it. But I think it just depends on the kiddo.
I totally agree with what you said there, Steffi. For Tristan, I believe he'll probably need physical therapy up until he can do all the same activities as the other kids that he goes to school with, I guess. And so when he can run and climb and jump and do all those things and he's more stable, he still trips a lot. Just tonight, he just fell flat on his face, just walking.
Poor baby.
Just walking, poor guy. And so he got up and he gets really upset and embarrassed now when he falls. And he just trips. So I know it breaks my heart. So I'm keeping him in therapy as long as I can, because like Steffi was saying, the pediatrician and the insurance, it has to be justified. And so we keep a pretty extensive record of everything that's going on with him. And then we have to do evaluations every 6 months to see where he's falling. We actually just did it for speech. So I'm waiting to see what those results are for his receptive language and expressive language. And if there's a large gap, then speech therapy would be required. And the same thing for physical therapy. As far as occupational therapy for Tristan, he needs it. This boy he can be so good with a, you know, a Ziploc bag. He can pull that open, which is fine motor, which is what OTs focus on. But when it comes to something like holding a crayon and applying pressure to the paper, he struggles with that. So I think he'll need occupational therapy probably beyond the other therapies because most kids that are 4 years old can hold a pen to or a crayon to paper and make a really solid line. And that's not something that he can do yet, but I know he can do it.
Right.
So we're going to keep pushing, just not yet. So we'll keep pushing that. So yeah, I agree. It depends on the kid. It really does.
Yeah. I would say the same for Lane. I feel like we just kind of do it on a need to basis. Like what Steffi was saying, I took him out of some therapies and then had to put him back in. But Paige, along with what you were saying, Lane is the same way. Like with OT, OT will be a therapy that is on our plate for a long time. He's the same way. Like I watch him try and hold a pen, but he struggles with things like even getting himself dressed and whatnot. So OT is like a huge therapy for my little guy. Paige, with that newer diagnosis, did you have to add therapies onto your plate, or was it pretty straightforward with the same therapies that he's already had?
Yeah, a lot of the same therapies. Mm-hmm. I'm going to add ABA. We actually did our assessment with the ABA therapist last week, Friday, which was a complete and total disaster. Oh, anything that could go wrong went wrong. I was an emotional wreck after that was done. And it was, my mom came to my rescue that evening and I was like, can you just give me like 5 minutes so I can just go lay on my bed in my bedroom and stare off into space and wonder what just happened. It was like I lived through a war, and it was a 3-hour consult evaluation, you know. It was not an all-day event, but in the 3-hour time span, I was supposed to feed Tristan lunch because she wanted to see that. I was supposed to have baby Ezra and him interact, have him interact with me, and then simultaneously answer all of her questions.
Oh gosh.
Which I could do that. I can handle things, but for some reason, Friday was not the day to handle it. So we added that, and I'm waiting. I think because of how rough that was, I think every time there was a behavior she noticed or something to work on, she put a little check mark on her paper, and it made my anxiety so much worse when she did that. But I know she's just doing her job, so I'm definitely not hating on it. It just, it was a lot of pressure. So I think she added about 15 check marks in a 3-hour time span, which she said our 3-hour time span translated into her asking for the most support for Tristan, because I told her that was also one of his worst days. That was a really, really, really bad afternoon. So she's going to request a lot of hours for us, which I don't know what that's going to end up looking like.
Okay. And from an ABA therapist standpoint.
Tell us, Steffi.
Tell us.
I will. I'll give you the background. So most of the time they are going to request the most hours possible. So it's actually probably not necessarily a reflection of your kiddo, because what happens is they have to go to insurance. They treat it like a prescription. So they're like, your child needs 40 hours a week. That's literally what the typical amount was that would be requested for a child that just got a diagnosis. So like age 3, they request about 40 hours to insurance, and about most of the time insurance is going to come back and say, nope, we'll give you 23 or whatever it is. So it's almost this wager game with insurance. So a lot of the times they will go in and request more, knowing that it's probably going to get countered back at something else. So that's a lot of the time. It's probably not. Yeah, so it's probably not really a reflection of your kiddo. They do often request more. Again, it's always easier to start with a lot and then be able to show progress and dwindle down once they're making progress and they get a better feel. Whereas going back to insurance and being like, oh, actually, we need more hours, they're going to be like, no.
I'm glad to hear that, because I really thought that day was just a total disaster. And I told this sweet, sweet therapist, I bet you're never going to walk into my house ever again.
Tristan probably made their day.
He did. He was really nice at the end and he blew her kisses. So
will he be having ABA at your home?
Yeah. So you can tell me if this is correct or not, Steffi. I read somewhere that ABA is more effective or has higher success rates when it's in a therapy center versus in home.
The company that I was working for, we actually, because of that research, went all center-based. our only clients that we had that were home-based were ones that had been around for a really long time. And I will say, as from my personal perspective, I think that center-based is great, but I also think that home-based sessions are important, because whenever you're at the center, mom and dad are usually dropping kiddo off, and then it's just you and the client working for a while. And while you can get a lot done, there's not a lot of distractions, it gives you more time to like hyper-focus on the actual programs. When it comes to managing behaviors, the chances of seeing what's going on at home with mom and dad aren't going to pop up. So managing those behaviors of how to help with home life is going to be important too. So my personal perspective is that you need a balance.
That's a really great way to put it. We have been center-based for 2 years and I love it. I do feel like when Lane did therapies at home, like whether it was developmental, occupational, speech, I felt like he almost felt like my house, my rules, I don't have to sit here with you. And he kind of just didn't put in as much effort as he does at the center. Yeah. So we have been center-based for 2 years, but then there are, now that he's getting, you know, he's going to be 5 in July, I'm like, there's certain life skills that I wish she could work with him here at home, you know, or even just be here when he's getting dressed or brushing, is just stuff like that.
And that's a lot of what my concern was, which is why they said they were going to do majority home in home for him, because nobody else saw these behaviors, which is why nobody else even initially thought he needed the autism diagnosis. And it took us so long to get to that point. So she said she'll do majority at home if this is how it is at home. Steffi, I know we've talked a lot about how the foundation of Tulips is built on the idea of you wanting a community. Tell us, who did you most rely on once you received your diagnosis? Did you join any support groups?
You know, I don't think I joined any support groups. I did actually quite a bit later. And I'll be honest, I had this mentality that I was like, I'm not going to be that person that's going to all the Down syndrome things. I'm not going to, like, I just want to treat my child like they're typical. And that was my thought process. I was like, I don't want to be involved in everything. I don't want to be involved in the mom groups. I don't want to have 18 Facebook groups. Like, that was just my thought process. And unfortunately, it started feeling really isolating. And I had a lot of friends at the time who had just had babies, and I loved them. But it was just different. Like, they just didn't quite understand what I was going through. And so I really started having this deep longing for connection somewhere. So I actually got involved in Gigi's Playhouse. We had one in San Diego, and now I'm involved in the one here in Phoenix/Scottsdale. And I love it. And I love that Joshua gets to go and be around his peers with Down syndrome. They have amazing programs and the parents stay. It's basically like free programs and therapies for your kiddo, and they're with other children specifically with Down syndrome. So Joshua had been going to music therapy class there at the Gigi's in San Diego since he was like 4 months old. And he had a bunch of little friends who are right around his same age that he would see every week when we went. And I would get to connect with the moms, which was awesome. And then I actually connected with a bunch of moms on social media. I don't even know how I got added in this group. Taylor from the House of Wheeler had started this group on social media with a few other moms, and she invited me to join, and I was like, sure, I'd love to. And I don't know, you guys are both in the group. That's how we met, and they are just some of my best friends. They've been my go-to, and I feel like I can always really connect with them. And then I attended a conference when Joshua was just a few months old that was specific for moms who had children with Down syndrome. And I met two moms there who I connected with immediately, and we kept in touch ever since. We've since had like a family get together where all our families met up because we're from different states, and I talk to them both regularly as well. So it's kind of a bummer that my like support system, I guess, is almost online. They're not necessarily in my state where I'm close with them, but I'm grateful that I at least have a support system somewhere. So Paige, if you had to say, what is the outlet that provided you the most comfort and support after the diagnosis?
So I wouldn't necessarily say it was an outlet. I just leaned a lot on my faith, and I prayed a lot and I cried a lot. I played a lot of worship music and I leaned a lot on that. And I did look at social media, which helped me a lot. I was started seeing things on Google, like what you said earlier. Google is not your friend. Google is not your friend at all, actually. And so everything we saw on Google was just horrible. When I would say my baby has low muscle tone, really low muscle tone, and I'd see all these horrible things about kids with low muscle tone, and I just couldn't believe that that was even real. And I would just be so devastated after looking at Google. And then I would go on social media and try to find some fun Down syndrome hashtags or special needs hashtags. And I found these incredible moms that I followed. And you were one of them, Steffi, and aww, Taylor was one of them. I know there can be some competition like with any other community, but I always feel like our friend group at least tries to put community and support over the competition. And that has made it a safe place for me to be able to seek support in that community.
Yeah.
All right. And we're going to roll into our Q&A segment where we answer a question from our Instagram sticker box. So the question today is, how did you tell friends and family?
Well, I will start. I don't think I specifically, I mean, I think close friends and family, I just picked up the phone and told them all. We all kind of knew it was coming. I talked to my mom and my sister like 20 times a day. So they basically knew it was coming just like we did, I feel like. And then as far as social media, which sounds crazy to even bring that up, but with it being, you know, 2021, I remember I posted a video 2 years ago of Lane speaking for the first time. He said my niece's name. He was like, Summer. And it was the first time I ever heard him say anything. And so I was super emotional and I posted the video on Facebook and said something about how it made my whole trip. And I could tell it kind of got people, I had people texting me on the side or direct messaging me being like, you know, is something going on with Lane? Because I think everyone was kind of like, what do you mean? It's his first word. You know, he's over the age of two. So I felt like people kind of started to sense it and were asking friends behind my back, you know, nothing bad, but just saying, you know, is there something going on with Sarah's son? So then I gave it a couple weeks and I just made a whole post and I actually shared the Welcome to Holland poem. And that was kind of like my post to just let everyone know more or less, because I was just tired of answering everybody's like side questions. And yeah, I just figured I would let everyone know. And like I said, family kind of knew it was coming. As for Hope, which I didn't even touch on her at all this episode, but with Hope, my friends knew that I was taking her to get in my family. Knew that I was taking to get her swabbed at Lane's annual Fragile X appointment. So they kind of knew that I should be getting results soon. And I mean, I got that phone call when I was sitting in just like a Target parking lot, go figure. and I just texted all my friends and I was like, I got the news back. And then they all tried calling me, but I was like ugly crying in my car by myself and didn't want to talk. So I think they just picked up on it and they were all so sweet. My best friend started a meal train that week so that all of my friends like took turns bringing meals just so we could like focus on being with Hope and not have to, it was one less thing to worry about. So it was really nice, but
that's so thoughtful.
I took her diagnosis like 10 times harder for some reason than Lane's. I think because I really, really believed that she wasn't going to have it. So super sweet. And my friends were great. And I can't imagine like not having told them right away or family, because I mean, the support at the end of the day is like, it just was amazing and exactly what I needed. So
I'll share mine. I called my family and I just told them on the phone. I also told my close friends on the phone. So they all knew about the potential prenatal diagnosis. And then I sent them a photo of him at the hospital after, when we kind of did our birth announcement. I like to send birth announcements to friends and family separately first before they see it on social media.
For sure.
So I sent that to them, and in it, I, you know, obviously explained like Joshua James Kirpin has arrived sporting his extra chromosome. So they all knew, you know, he did have Down syndrome. And then as for like acquaintances on social media, I'm not going to lie, I actually would only post, and I feel really guilty about this, but I just didn't know how to tell people. I'm like, how do I tell random strangers that my child has Down syndrome? And, you know, I didn't have a ton of followers. It was like people from high school that I went to school mm-hmm. with in college, and like random people I'd met through work. And I didn't feel like I necessarily owed them anything. But at the same time, I wanted to be able to post pictures of my family and my child without feeling like I need to explain things every yeah. time. So the first few months, I would post pictures of him only with his eyes shut, or like, you know, side angles, because I just didn't want to have to explain that. And I didn't know how. And so I finally mustered up the courage. I think at his like 2 or 3 month photo, I posted and I just shared, you know, about how our pregnancy was hard, but we made it through. And Joshua, you know, God chose us to be his parents, and he has Down syndrome, and we're going to be his biggest cheerleaders and all this stuff. That's what, how I shared it on social media. How about you, Paige?
I just pulled up one of my announcements here on Facebook, because as you were saying that, I actually did not post his pictures until 4 days after he was born, because we were in the NICU and he was not doing very well. Although we tried to frame it as he's going to be out really soon. The reality of that now that I can look back is, he was not doing well. He could not keep his oxygen saturation high enough at all. And every 15 or 20 minutes, his monitors would go off, and then he couldn't finish a bottle. And it was just a lot of stress. So I actually didn't even post announcing his birth, never mind a diagnosis, until he was 4 days old and he was in the NICU.
Which I don't blame you. Yeah, you had a lot going on.
Right? I just a little bit going on. And I'm reading it right now, and I did not say anything about his diagnosis then. Although we knew he had Down syndrome at 4 days, we didn't get the official paperwork until he was about 10 days old. So I think possibly around 2 or 3 weeks old, I announced. I know it took me a long time to get to the point where I could handle people asking me questions about it without breaking down. And I, even though I thought I was at that point, I think it took me an additional 4 months to get to the point where people could ask me questions about his birth story and about him and about Down syndrome, where I didn't immediately burst into tears or completely clam up, which if you know me, I am a talker. So when I clam up, something is wrong.
I was going to say, you clam up? What?
Yeah, me. So it took me a while. And we told, just like you guys, we told our friends, our close friends that were on this pregnancy journey with us, and our family, we told them in person, and both of our mothers were here supporting us, because at one point we were told that Tristan would be stillborn. So everybody was pretty close by, and my mother-in-law was in the delivery room with us, and my mom was there, and my sister was there. So the people that mattered the most to us knew that They were on the same path that we were, because we were all in this weird limbo of waiting for a diagnosis. So mm-hmm. when we found out, they also found out, and they were waiting on the edge of their seats as well. But for the social media world at large, I think I just waited till I was comfortable to ask questions, because I feel like with social media, people tend to be more fearless with their questions and less mm-hmm. considerate of how they ask it. Oh, he's got a good head of hair, but wow, his eyes are different. You know, things like that they would say. And sometimes to a new mom, you can't always handle people's careless words. And so right. I was really, really nervous about that after having seen how hostile social media can be when it's something different that someone's never been exposed to, which was a huge part of how I got into our advocacy, because I wanted to have people treat Tristan the way I wanted them to, not the way their preconceived stereotypes and passive notions of it were.
I think it's so important, like you said, to just share when you're ready.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I encouraged a new mom actually this past week to share with her close support system as soon as she's comfortable, because those are the ones that are going to be supporting you and helping you through the grieving process and helping you through the hard days. But when you're comfortable to share with the world, that's a whole nother story, because they're not walking with you every single day through it, but your close support system, they're going to be there for you and they're going to want to support you. So I always advocate for sharing and being as transparent as you can in that moment, but also know it's really hard to do that too. So you just have to do what's right for you.
Love it.
Well, you guys, that completes our episode. And we can't tell you how thankful we are that you tuned in. If you guys are interested in supporting Tulips, there's a few ways to get involved. First, you can support us by heading to our shop and checking out our merchandise. We love seeing you guys rocking your Tulips merch. Second, if you're loving Tulips, you can become an official Tulips patron by becoming a monthly subscriber and earning patron-only perks. And lastly, you can help us by spreading the word about Tulips. If you think you or someone you love would be a great fit for a Tulips takeover or guest host on the podcast, be sure to fill out the contact form on our website.